Welcome to Dish the Dirt, a light-hearted and fun podcast about Australian flower growers, their stories, knowledge and insights into the industry. I'm your host Rebecca, and each week I speak to a different farmer and get them to dish the dirt. Dish the Dirt acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognise their continuing connection to land, water and community. We pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. Hello and welcome to another week of Dish the Dirt. This is episode 3 of season 6 and this month marks a pretty big milestone for Dish the Dirt. The first episode aired in July 2020. So thank you so much to everyone who listens, contributes and supports this podcast. Sharing these stories is such a privilege, and I will never tire of talking to the hardworking people behind our flower farms. If you look out over Instagram this month, I will be doing a few giveaways just to celebrate the fact that it's been this many years. But this week, we speak to Charlotte from September Peony Farm. Charlotte and her mother, Kim, established a cut flower farm in 2021 following a small trial period with peonies. Their farm is located in the Granite Belt, roughly 40 minutes north of Tenterfield and 20 minutes outside of Stanthorpe on the border of Queensland and New South Wales. Charlotte's love of cut flowers made them an excellent complement to the oak trees they had already planted to grow truffles during the winter months. Charlotte also has a full-time corporate role, which she loves, and has resulted in the farm being a team effort as it grows. The farm has a focus on perennials, including peonies, which can bloom as early as September and inspired the name. They also have roses, iris, and have a significant focus on dahlias and other more unique architectural varieties such as amaranth. The farm range of flowers and seasonal availability is rapidly increasing as it grows. They are very excited about new additions to the farm, including snapdragons, ranunculus campanula, hydrangea and delphiniums. Thank you so much, Charlotte, for sharing your story and how you established your cut flower farm. It really is a wonderful talk. I hope everyone enjoys it. Let's get into it. I was just searching for vases online, so I got a bit of a surprise. I just had my headphones in. You know when you're like a million miles away? No, it's fine. It's totally fine. I was expecting you to answer. It's just I was in vase land. How was your day?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I've had a bit of a crazy week. I've managed to be between Brisbane, the Gold Coast, Sydney and Melbourne. Twice, like I was Sydney, Brisbane, Gold Coast, Melbourne, Sydney, Gold Coast.
Oh my goodness.
So sorry, I had to reschedule and
trying
to pick what was the safest thing that I wouldn't, you know, have a flight come up or something cause a disruption. But
wow. What do you do for work outside of the farm? And do you mind saying?
No. So I have a full-time corporate job. I'm a tax lawyer. At a big accounting firm.
Amazing.
So, I love it. It's fantastic. I really enjoy it. But it's a bit hectic.
Sounds it. Goodness.
I know. I was so exhausted last night when I got home.
I bet you were. Well, thank you for fitting me in.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Schedule. So do you want to start me off by telling explaining to me sort of where you're situated in Australia?
Sure, yep. So our farm is on the Granite Belt, which is on the border of New South Wales and Queensland. It's about 40 minutes north of Tenterfield and 20 minutes outside of a town called Stanthorpe, which is a Queensland town, which, you know, Queensland locals will recognise, but I guess more broadly it's 2.5 hours outside of Brisbane.
Okay.
And it's in line with Byron Bay,
Okay.
So it's that sort of latitude, but it's really elevated. So it gets really cold over winter.
Okay.
It's kind of, you know, it snows every couple of years or every few years.
Wow.
So it's,
okay.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a unique Queenslandy climate. It's technically in New South Wales, but yeah, it's right on that border.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say when you said cold, I'm like, what's cold to you?
No, like properly cold. But, okay. Yeah.
And how did you end up there?
Oh, the opportunity just came up to sort of set something up out there maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. And we'd been looking around generally. We just sort of had the ability to be remote, but you know, new people that we could sort of engage. So the farm was set up as a truffle farm.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have just shy of 3,000 oak trees.
Wow.
And so that was what we did, you know, for the first 2 years or 3 years, set that up sort of exclusively. So it was so that was really dictated by the climate. You had to be somewhere cold. And I was living in Brisbane at the time, so it made the most sense from that perspective.
Mm.
Now that I live in Sydney, it makes a lot less sense. But you know, sometimes things work like that. It's a really sort of unique town. It's a unique climate. It's quite good being out there.
Yeah. So how did you, so it's yourself and your mum, is that correct?
Yeah. So my dad was very involved, but he passed away a couple of years ago.
I'm sorry.
And it's sort of been my, I don't know, brainchild from the beginning, and they've sort of funded it been very enthusiastically involved. And like I said, it was originally for truffles, and then, you know, truffles are only a winter thing, but they also take a really long time to get any truffles at all.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, we'd sort of set that up, and then we're looking at years and years and years of, okay, now we just wait. I was like, well, what can we do in the meantime? And, you know, we'd had all this infrastructure there for the truffles, like, you know, massive water tanks and irrigation infrastructure, and the property is quite big. And I love flowers, as most people do. But, you know, I thought, oh, well, flowers would be something that complements it the other 9 months of the year, you know, when outside of winter. And so it would utilize the infrastructure that we've kind of got the rest of the year.
Yeah, wonderful. And what year did you decide to start with your flowers?
So the first sort of peonies we put in, which were a bit of a trial, went in when the truffle trees went in, and that was 2018.
Okay.
And they have been utterly neglected ever since that trial patch, and have been picked up and moved just recently to somewhere where they'll get much better attention. But they survived and flowered. You know, we got a couple of flowers, and that was sort of proof enough, because nobody grows peonies there. So that was proof enough to me that theoretically it could work.
Wonderful.
So it was probably the next year, 2019, that we did our first main planting of flowers, which was peonies and some roses. And at that time I bought a very small number of dahlias and a small number of hydrangeas, which I killed very quickly. But sort of that was probably the start of then going more and more into flowers. And then each year has just been, you know, bigger than the one before.
Yeah, wonderful. So what's been sort of your biggest learning curve from 2018 until now?
Oh, I think, there's so many different areas that I've learned a lot more about as we go on. For me, I don't have a horticultural background.
Yeah.
So learning how to grow different types of flowers and what conditions they really need and what will work and what the way you can set it up that makes the process more efficient and productive. And I'm still learning that. Like, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm still learning that. And maybe just even how to approach things. You know, I sort of have an approach now of I'll just think about one flower at a time. Like, you want to grow so many things. You have the capacity to grow so many things, but it gets really overwhelming, particularly when you're growing it for the first time. Well, I found it overwhelming, you know, about where to start. So now I just have an approach of work out what I do with one flower at a time. So we're putting in a lot of new things this year for next year. And so when I was planning and working out how that would work in the farm, you know, I just focused on Lysianthus because, you know, Lysianthus have their groups, 1 to 4, and there's a bit to understanding how that works from a planting and flowering perspective. So in earlier years that had sort of just been beyond me. But, you know, I've taken this approach now of, okay, just one flower at a time.
So yeah,
what do you do with Lysianthus? Okay, I work that out. It's in the plan. It's ordered. It, you know, the timing's done. Okay, now what's the next flower? Like, you know, and approach it that way, which I sometimes look back and can't remember at all about why I decided to do something on a particular date. So I just trust myself that I looked it up at the time and I knew what it was then. So we're just rolling with that.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So did you find it hard to find any sort of Australian-based knowledge when you got into flower farming?
Yeah, hugely.
Yeah,
In fact, I still don't really have a main source of Australian-based flower knowledge in terms of the horticultural side of it. I tend to use, you know, the gardener's workshop, so Lisa Mason Ziegler. Florette has a huge amount of information out there. A group of people organized to buy Dr. Alan Armitage's book recently, and I got a copy as part of that thing, and that's an amazing book. The problem, of course, with using American information is that you have to flip your seasons and pay really close attention to what zone they're talking about and whether or not it's applicable. So you have to do a bit of mental gymnastics whenever you're dealing with American information. But it's all entirely applicable.
Yeah.
You just have to understand what the differences are and take that into account when you're reading about it. On a sort of smaller note, there's some great Facebook groups around where you can pose growing questions or business questions in the Australian market and get some really good feedback from people. And suppliers of plants are really, you know, generous with their information as well and what they think. So that's good. But as a rule, I would say it's been a struggle to get Australian-based horticultural information.
Yeah.
And I think something that's really different as well is that if you look at America, the state government agencies play a really big role in research and development, in trials, in the publication and dissemination of information, in hands-on assistance if you have to do things like soil tests. They have a government framework which is really supportive of not just flower growing but agriculture in general, and I think that's really absent in Australia. The state that does it best that I've been able to see is Western Australia. If you Google for Australian horticultural information and cut flower industry, you'll often find the guides that were put out by a particular guy. I can't remember his name, but he clearly was quite enthusiastic, and he must have been employed in WA in the agriculture department at some stage, because he's gone away and written a whole lot of sort of guides, which, you know, sadly are getting more and more out of date, and I don't think they're getting updated. But, yeah, there is a stark difference. I think if people again, it goes back to that idea of one flower at a time. I think if people take the American information, which there's an absolute abundance of, you know, stem counts on plants and the impact of you're holding temperatures at 5 degrees versus 7 degrees. And, you know, there's so much information. I think if people just take it one flower at a time, you know, this American study, what zone were they talking about? Double check that the zone correlates to your, you know, your zone for that season. You know, if you just take it slowly, give yourself a bit of slack to get your head around it.
Yeah.
Then it's all useful information that you can apply. But, yeah, it would be great to have more of that specific to Australia, particularly as well for people that are growing natives, because that's not as pop, you know, Australian or South African plants aren't as popular in the US, so they're often not,
yeah, of course,
you know, in those publications that you can otherwise get a hold of.
Yeah. And since you began, have you met any other flower farmers around your area who are sort of growing in the same climate as you? Has that helped at all? Well, there's just no one really.
There are some other flower farmers. I don't know that they're the ones we've necessarily chatted to the most. Janelle at Byron Bay Organic Flower Farm. She's lovely. I know you've had her on last season. Great. And, you know, she will share as much information with you as she has. And she's been wonderful, but she's not the same zone as us by any means. Stuart Pearson is a big eucalyptus grower, a native foliage grower, and he has a plantation near us. And I talk to him you know, reasonably regularly and see what he's doing and what he's up to. But again, he's really focused on sort of foliage varieties rather than cut flowers. So it's not directly applicable. We grow dahlias and Florally is the best, you know, just so wonderful and generous with her time. So if I have any dahlia related questions, I always ask her, and she's down much closer to you in Victoria.
Yeah.
But I think that's the wonders of the internet and social media, you know, that you have access to so many people located all over the place that you can ask questions of and get information back, and that's been really great.
Yeah. So what's your dream for the next 5 years for the farm?
So I think to just grow the variety of cut flowers that to expand our variety so that we're sort of I find that it's hard for people to buy from us in bigger volumes without us being able to provide a wide variety.
Okay.
Which makes total sense, you know, for a lot of florists, maybe they can take 20 bunches of something, but it doesn't mean they can take 100, you know. So you have to sort of have that ability to say, okay, you can take 20 bunches of that, but here are 5 or 6 other things that you also might really like. And then you're talking about an order size that really works for us as a business. We're always looking to grow our customer base in Brisbane and the Gold Coast, and I'd really like to see it expand down into Sydney, which because of the sort of freight network, Stanthorpe produces a lot of fruit and, you know, vegetables generally, so it's got really good freight infrastructure in and out of it.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so we can send a pallet of flowers to Sydney overnight and they're there the next day.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so we can provide really fresh, you know, locally grown, high quality flowers. So it's just about persevering with that, growing that, and continuing to work with some of the fantastic wholesalers that have supported us so far, you know, being so new, providing constructive feedback where we could improve the way we were doing things. I think that's really the long-term goal, just to continue growing the business.
Yeah, and lovely. And so what's sort of the volume that you're growing on at the moment?
So we grow on 5 acres.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not small.
No, that's not small.
And it's all field grown. We don't have any greenhouses. We okay. have put in a whole lot of shade infrastructure of yeah. varying degrees of shade.
For your hydrangea?
Exactly. Yeah. I have ordered also for the peonies, actually. Oh, we're just okay. a bit too hot in summer.
Right. And the sun
really knocks them back in that really hot summer. So I'm hoping that under some shade, even though peonies are normally a full sun plant, if you look at most of the people that grow peonies in northern New South Wales and up, you'll see they actually do have them under shade cloth.
Ah, interesting.
Okay. Yeah, it's been things like that. You know, again, learning curve, like one flower at a time, right? You've got to adjust. And so when we freight things, we freight them by the pallet load. So which is about, depending on what it is you buy, you know, 80 bunches-ish.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. Which people can buy less, of course. It's just whether it's as economical for them to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you package when you're selling by the pallet? Do you use plastic wrap? Do you use rubber bands, just buckets?
So we do use rubber bands and we often do use plastic sleeves.
Yeah.
We partly have to do that for the wholesalers.
Yeah.
So that it's getting to them as a product that's not too labor intensive for them to then sell.
Yeah, okay.
Some flowers you can't plastic sleeve. We don't plastic sleeve our cafe au lait dahlias, for example, because the heads are so big you can't put them in a plastic sleeve. We don't plastic sleeve our amaranth, which is so hardy that they just do not need it. Same with the celosia.
Mm.
It's just not necessary. But things like the smaller dahlias, the roses, things like that do get put in plastic. And then everything's freighted in water.
Yeah.
So everything's in buckets in water. We feel that's really important to make sure that the flowers get where they're going in the best condition they can.
Yeah.
And, yeah, then it's just on a pallet, in a pallet bin. It gets covered by a sort of cover on the truck. We did, before doing that, we did send a couple of pallets at one stage and they went to a couple of different people and I woke up in the morning and I had all these text messages being like, our flowers have arrived. They're all dead. Well, not all dead, but most of them are dead. Oh, I just died on the inside.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, what's gone wrong? It turns out on the truck they were placed too close to the chiller unit.
Oh, and it just
killed them all. Because we maintain cold freight the whole way from the farm to Brisbane or wherever they're going, you know, until the customer picks them up. So they get a cover on them now.
That they don't die on the truck. Happened to me before. I remember I did this huge wedding and it was one of my first weddings and really, really big. And I had, I don't know, something like close to 60 centerpieces in this big chiller unit that we'd hired. And the guy set the temperature wrong.
No.
And I couldn't even open the chiller door the next morning because it was so frozen closed. So you can just imagine what all those flowers looked like when I opened it and I cried. I spent the whole entire day crying.
I pulled it off and remade
every single centerpiece. Before the wedding, but I cried the whole entire day. It was the worst day of my life.
So we got our cold room and there was a lot of double checking about what temperature that cold room was meant to be at for all the different flowers. I was just like, I'm not getting this wrong. It's a big thing. It's one of those lessons you only learn once and then you don't take any chances with it again.
Yeah, exactly. So how did you reach out to wholesalers in the beginning? Did you get into it? Sorry, I should just backtrack. When you first started, sat down and said, okay, we want to make this into a viable business, did you sort of write down who you would reach out to, or did you it just happen organically?
Well, it was interesting. So the peonies we always knew were going to take quite a while to flower. And as I said, the roses and the dahlias at the very start, we didn't have that many of them. It was more a let's see how they go type approach.
Yeah.
And I had started an Instagram page thinking, well, you may as well start, you know, and put photos up and it'll grow organically and down the track that would be beneficial. And with COVID and the lack of flowers coming into the country because there were no flights, florists are really struggling to get product that they could use. And to be honest, it was probably a bit of desperation on their side. But I got contacted by, you know, some lovely people that ended up being customers. But they just really needed flowers. And I, you know, I had some personal stuff going on at that point in time. But, you know, it was mum and I driving out, you know, hours in a car, harvesting flowers, driving back hours. You know, it was completely unviable from an economic perspective, totally not viable. But what it did is – it said to us, okay, people will buy the flowers, you know, like this is something that possibly has legs. And then we were sort of umming and ahhing about what to do in terms of investing in the farm. How big do we make it? And we had a wholesaler contact me out of the blue. Again, I think because of the absolute lack of ability to get flowers in Australia, and say, what do you have? And I effectively said, oh, nothing, but we are thinking of doing things in a much bigger way. And that started a conversation. And we went in and met with them, and they were incredibly helpful. Very generous with their information and their time about how things would work, what things worked well, what things didn't. And mum and I walked away from that and thought, well, this might work. And because we aren't on farm, my mum's since retired, but we both had full-time jobs off farm at that point.
Okay.
We kind of had to say, well, we go big or we go home, right? We do this in a way where it very quickly becomes viable, quickly in the context that any business quickly becomes viable, but, you know, it very quickly sort of starts to stand on its own. And we give that a crack, or we just walk, you know, we just really step back from the flower side. Anyway, we gave it a really big crack at starting at the end of last year, and it's gone quite well. And it was interesting. We actually didn't end up selling any flowers to that particular wholesaler, but it probably gave me enough confidence to approach the other wholesalers, which we do have as customers, and they've been wonderful. You know, Sharon at Petal Peddlers buys our flowers. Guys out at Gold Coast Flower Markets, Redlands, they're lovely. You know, they're really pro supporting the Australian industry. They sometimes get stuff from us. And their sort of willingness to give constructive feedback rather than just stop buying something from you is worth its absolute weight in gold.
Fabulous.
You know, because we're very, you know, I think most businesses are the same, or I'd hope they're the same. You're very, very willing to improve and do whatever is required to make sure that the product you're sending out the door is the best it possibly can be. And as someone new in the industry, it's hard to get that right on day one.
Yeah, of course.
So they've, you know, they've been really wonderful to work with. And we have a number of florists who are really wonderful and buy from us directly. We've just been lucky. You know, I sort of sometimes look at mum and because, you know, the going big in flowers was contacting Ball Australia and buying this huge amount of plugs and putting them all in and just seeing how it went. And there really was not much planning or method to my madness. It was what are on your extra ops lists that I can get right now, and let's put that in. And, you know, it was just amazing how far that approach did get us, because we don't have much available at the moment. We have ornamental kale, some gomphrena, you know, there's not much. And that was definitely a lack of organization on my behalf around succession planning and, you know, what crops do you need to fill what seasonal gaps. And so we've got that a lot more worked out for next year, you know, September onwards. But I can't remember what your original question was on that little.
Neither can I, but that's okay. No, I think you answered it very well. It was about how did you end up reaching out to wholesalers, and, you know, we've segued into talking about wholesalers and how supportive they've been. So that's great to hear. I know I have spoken to a few wholesalers, and they just really want smaller farms to succeed and thrive, because then they get big, you know, better flowers to sell to their customers too, which is, it's a win-win for everyone.
I think you have to be realistic. Not that I want to have the pricing conversation. I think you have to be realistic, though, that they have to run a viable business.
Yeah.
And they've got their pressures on their side. Mm-hmm. And you have to try and do everything you feasibly can to help them. So, you know, trying to package things how they want it at our end, you know, taking all that feedback, trying to act on it, implement it so that when it gets to them it's less work, and understanding if our bunch sizes are off, if that's not quite what their customer is after. Like, rather than taking any of it as, I guess, something negative, it's all positive. It's all them helping you help them. And so I think just, you know, if you're a smaller grower and you're looking to supply to a wholesale market, it's understanding that side of it as well, right? They have their own customers, and it is the same if you're selling to florists, but florists do so much value add and so much prep on the flowers that whether you're, I'm not going to be able to come up with a good example here, but, you know, the product is substantially transformed in the hands of a florist versus in the hands of a wholesaler.
Yes.
So I think you have to be much more appreciative of the demands on the wholesaler on that front.
Yeah.
Whereas a florist may be more flexible about how have you bunched it, have you used a rubber band or not, have you sleeved it or not. Like, maybe there's more room to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Than there would be with a wholesaler.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are really good points to make. Do you have anyone on the farm now? I know you said you were both off farm at that point.
Yes, so, we have Elise, who is our farm manager. She's a trained florist and she is a godsend.
Yeah.
I don't know where we'd be without her. It was funny, really. Fate works in odd ways. She was a trained florist and wanted to work on a flower farm and had put feelers out in various forums about wanting to do that. But I was actually out at dinner with a good girlfriend of mine saying how, you know, we really wanted someone who was very passionate and had a bit of an in-depth understanding of flowers, or understood flowers, you know, and understood the quality of flowers to be out there, and sort of saying to her, oh, I don't know where on earth we'd find that person necessarily. And she said, oh, a girl I used to go to school with is a florist and wants to go work on a flower farm. Why don't I see if she'd be interested? I could put you guys in touch. Anyway, fate, you know, she was, Elise was very keen to come out, and she came out at the end of last year when we we didn't really know where things were going to go. It was all a work in progress. And she's just wonderful. She takes on every challenge, and she has a background in the Air Force, so she's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, wonderful.
She definitely, you know, having someone like that makes running a business remotely feasible. Otherwise, you know, you'd have no chance. If you've not got the right team, if you've not got the right support framework, you can't really get anywhere fast, you know.
Yeah. And what's been your biggest achievement, do you think, to date?
I'm just thinking I knew that this was a question you might ask. I just struggle with that. I think just sticking with it through, you know, some of the ups and downs, and giving it a really red hot crack, and we're not sort of giving up, and actually being able to self-rest.
Yeah, amazing.
is probably the biggest achievement on the farm sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And who has inspired you the most, do you think, to kind of keep going and to give this a good crack?
Oh, definitely my mum.
Okay. Yeah.
Definitely my mum. You know, I think that sort of works on multiple levels. Like, she's had enough faith in me to fund the whole thing. So I sort of feel this, like, I better make this work, you know.
Yeah.
Not that sort of ever leaves her mouth. I know when I, you know, get home from a full day of work and shut one computer, you know, put that client stuff away and open my other computer to start looking at spreadsheets of when stuff's arriving, when's it going to be planted, you know, what's going in that row, and thinking about what changes I might need to make, that sort of thing. And I just sort of say to her, oh, I'm so tired. She's just like, maybe it's too much, you know, maybe it's too much. And so she's very supportive in every single way. But, yeah, definitely her assistance on the farm and then all the support she's shown is my biggest motivating factor for just keeping on going with it.
Yeah.
Being like, no, I'm going to make this work. And it is working, but, you know, yeah, in terms of what really keeps me going, it's her and trying to make it successful for the both of us.
You all sound like powerhouses, really. Sounds like you've got
insane.
Yeah, you've all sounds like you've all got a good thing going, though, you know. All got your roles, and seems to be working really well.
I think that is a huge part of it, right? So mum recently stopped working and has taken over a lot of the sort of payroll admin, paying bills, you know, focusing on that sort of side of it. And that's been fantastic for me to stop doing that. And then Elise really focuses on executing the growing of the flowers and the other people that are out there to help her do that. And I sort of do sales, dealing with customers, and then the horticultural planning, for lack of a better description, like what are we going to buy, where are we going to plant it, when are we going to plant it, how do we need to improve the soil or do this or do that, you know. I do that side of it, plan that out for Elise to then execute. So it's not to say it all works seamlessly by any means, but we're definitely getting there as a team as to how to make it work productively and well for everyone.
Wonderful. It sounds amazing to me. Sounds like you're doing a great job. What do you love about being part of the Australian flower industry?
I mean, there's some really lovely people that are so generous with their time, like I said before, you know, and there's a really nice side to that. Plus, you're working with a beautiful product. And there's definitely something to be said about working with a product that you thoroughly enjoy. And yeah, I think those are probably the two main aspects, that there are some really nice people, and you're just doing something that's beautiful and sort of a joy to be involved in lots of the time.
Yeah. And is there anything since coming into the industry that you've noticed that you would like to see change? I know we sort of touched on it a little bit at the beginning about there not being as much research as what there is in the United States, but is there anything else that you've sort of noticed?
Yeah, I think, there's a lot of friction about pricing, and we don't need to talk about that. The only comment I'll make on that is it's an industry where there's such a gap between the big players and small players, like such a gap, you know, such different ends of the spectrum, that really drives a different cost of production really significantly at those ends, and then that sort of feeds into that conversation. But the thing that I actually really would like to see change is another sort of topical area, which is the country of origin labeling. Deloitte recently published a paper because it was looked at in the context of whether Australia's food country of origin labeling regulation or framework should be expanded, and Deloitte published a paper which basically said, nah, it doesn't need to be, it's good, leave it, which I disagree with on so many fronts. And I was previously used by Deloitte as a subject matter expert, not on flowers, but for a different consulting process when I worked there. And so I have a very small insight into how those processes run and work. And I think on this front, they totally dropped the ball. I don't think their observations support the recommendations. I don't think the recommendations are valid. I think they've missed really major issues, which include the fact that people are so unaware that flowers are imported, that they will use imported flowers in food products to be consumed. So those flowers have been doused in methyl bromide, and then they're thrown in a salad or on top of a cake, and it's like, it's a rose. Roses are edible. Yeah, sure, but I wouldn't eat one that's been covered in methyl bromide.
Yeah.
And the report just didn't even grasp that sort of nuance to the conversation. And it put a lot of words in the mouths of small growers. You know, one of the observations they made is that, it would just be too difficult for small growers to comply with country of origin labelling laws. And you're sort of sitting there thinking, who on earth did you speak to get that sort of feedback in a report? I mean, small growers, we grow all of our flowers in Australia. Our country of origin labelling requirements when we send it to a wholesaler easy as. You write on the invoice, grown in Australia, 100% Australian product. This is not a complicated environment. You know, if you're talking about groceries, you go along the chain, it gets a bit more complex. But unlike food, where I feel that consumers have a real interest in not just understanding whether it's imported or Australian grown. You have a real interest in understanding, well, what country is it imported from?
Yes.
Because the way I might view tomatoes that come in from Italy, or the way I might view tomatoes that come in, you know, from a Southeast Asian country, or, you know, but, you know, you're not one country can say to you, oh, this is really premium and worth more. Another country can say to you, oh, no, this is the cheaper end of the spectrum, you know? And so in food, there's a really big distinction in understanding what that country is. That doesn't really apply to flowers. People want to know, has this gone on a plane, you know, because it's carbon footprint is massively altered as a result. Has it been sprayed in pesticide? Because people have differing feelings on how much they want to be exposed to those chemicals. But it's more or less irrelevant whether you're buying a Dutch rose or a Kenyan rose, you know, like,
yeah,
they just want to know, is this Australian or is it overseas? So
yeah,
to expand the framework that exists for food into flowers, I feel like could be done in a really simplified way, because the consumer currently doesn't even know most of the time that imported flowers exist.
Yeah.
So to sort of read into it that then they're going to want you to distinguish between whether your rose is a Chilean or Kenyan is, you know, just absurd. Like, no, it's not that level of care factor.
No, no,
that
no.
Exists.
Yeah.
It's just, was it grown here or was it grown overseas? Like,
yeah,
that's the extent of it. And I do think that the combination of that information not being easily available for consumers, along with consumers as a starting point having generally no understanding or no knowledge that flowers can even be imported and often are, I do think it undermines locally grown product, because our cost of production is a lot higher, and even if you're aiming to be really competitive, some of those things you just can't get around. You know, our minimum wage is vastly higher. Our costs of inputs like fertilizer, et cetera, are significantly higher.
Big one, yeah.
Yeah, so, it's probably my little area of, I think.
And how do you feel about peonies being imported at this time of year? Is it something that concerns you?
That is a good question. That's a very good question, because I should clarify that I'm not against imports.
Yeah, okay.
I am not against imports. I am someone who would buy imported flowers myself.
Yeah.
You know, some of those David Austin roses that you see that come in, that go in bridal arrangements, are just divine, you know. Mm. And peonies in March, I mean, you can only get them imported in, you know. So if you really, I would not say to a bride, no, you shouldn't have peonies in your bouquet, they came from the US. Go for your life, you know.
Yeah.
I think flowers are there to bring enjoyment and for people to make people happy. So I am not against imports. I just think that at the cheaper end of flowers, people not understanding that that's even a thing is really undermining the ability for Australia to develop a reliable and sustainable cut flower industry. And I would think a lot of participants in the industry, having gone through COVID, would appreciate that we do want a reliable and sustainable domestic industry. Yeah. I mean, I'm so pro imports, particularly peonies in March, that my uncle, his wife's American, and I have said to him on numerous occasions, oh, would you like to go start a peony farm over there? And in March we'll bring the flowers over and sell them here. So, yeah, I'm definitely not against imports. I just think that there is no reason why the consumer shouldn't know that. And I personally don't eat flowers in any food product unless I actually know where they've come from. Like, I know that they've come from an Australian edible food grower or something. So I will buy edible flowers to maybe put in a salad or put on a cake, but I will, if I go anywhere, I won't eat them, because I have no idea whether the person purchasing that has understood, you know, how sprays and fumigation sort of work in the import process, and or just basically whether they're imported or not. So I wouldn't eat them.
Yeah, great points to make. And I think that will bring up, you know, a few questions for people when they listen to this episode. I just think everyone has the right to know where their product has come from, you know, and then they can make an educated decision as to what they want to do. So
I think so, and I think it's actually at the margins that you'll see movement. Like, I don't think you'll see people who would buy their flowers in Coles and Woolies suddenly stop buying flowers in Coles and Woolies because they say these are imported. Like, that's not where we're going to see movement or traction, or you know, and we're not going to get brides saying, oh, okay, just I won't have peonies. Like, no, like, if a bride wants a peony, she's gonna get them. Like, but it'll be just that you know, more aware consumer who, you know, down at the flower market or ordering a bouquet as a gift or, you know, something to put in their home. Like you will just get that market that's already probably the same way you did around food, people that are already taking carbon footprint or, you know, the use of chemicals into account, that they will start taking it into account. And I think that really does speak to what you said about just giving people the information, because if you're talking about that market, that is a market that cares, and they care when it comes to making decisions for themselves. And why aren't we giving them that information? I mean, it's hard being a consumer. You can't be an expert on everything.
I just wonder if it's because, and this is just my own personal thoughts, is because the Australian flower industry to the government is not a big enough industry for them to worry about.
Yeah. I think that could very well be part of it. I mean, the Deloitte report didn't really speak to that. It more seemed like perhaps there had been some loud voices somewhere within the industry that wanted to downplay it as an issue. But
yeah,
that's, you know, I could be entirely wrong. That's me reading between lines sort of in that report. But it is a smaller industry, but I always find that so ironic, because if you don't invest into an industry, how are you ever going to grow it?
Yeah.
You know, and you look at the value of flowers that are imported, and, you know, you do some like very broad brush maths on if you could convert some of that market to domestic purchase, and it's a more reasonable, you know, agricultural industry. Even like, you know, you spoke about peonies. They are so unique in that they are you can only grow them in particular places at particular times of the year, right, because they're so climate dependent, and there aren't very good methods for manipulating that in a greenhouse type environment. And they tried it in Israel, but I don't think on a broad scale it was very successful. So Australia, particularly southern states, cold states, have a real opportunity to go into that big. And we are the only state or the only country producing peonies at that time of year. I mean, there's some overlap probably with Chile and some of the South American countries. But, you know, New Zealand. But there's actually a real opportunity there. And New Zealand does it a bit more, exports more peonies than Australia does.
Yeah,
but,
which is, you know, crazy, isn't it? I know. The size of New Zealand, it's tiny.
And it also speaks to, well, that opportunity doesn't have to be, as in you don't have to be huge as an industry to feed into that market opportunity.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of market opportunity in exporting peonies, and they are such a high value flower that if brides have to pay $15 a stem by the time it lands to them in the UK, they'll pay $15 a stem because that's what they want. And it's just interesting that there hasn't been, you know, enough support for the industry for that to even really take off. You know, there's hardly enough peonies grown in Australia to satisfy Australian demand. So there is huge amounts of opportunity, particularly at that more high value stem end of the market, to be doing something more. I mean, you look at the Dutch, right? Dutch have the biggest flower industry in the world, and they're not a cheap economy. You know, they're not Chile, they're not Kenya. You know, what they are is highly productive, very high quality. And I just think it's a bit of a misconception that you couldn't get closer to that, you know.
Yeah. And it's also a conversation that we don't really have a lot about, is the exporting of flowers. You know, we always talk about importing flowers and sort of what we want to happen with imported flowers here, but no one really speaks about exporting their flowers overseas. So I don't know whether that's something that just doesn't happen a lot, like you're saying, or we haven't kind of tapped into it.
I definitely do not have the sort of industry knowledge. There's so many people that do, but, you know, I think historically, particularly around the native and South African variety market, there was quite a lot of exports and quite a lot going into Japan. And then if memory serves me correctly, which it may not, I think, you know, Japan went through a bit of economic hardship at some stage, and it really cut out some of the Australian exports in that market. And then what also happened, of course, is that Israel started growing Australian natives and growing them really well.
Yeah.
So you then sort of lost that side of it. But I think, you had them on one season, the guys that do the wax flower.
Helix.
Yes. Yeah. And I think I remember them saying that they did quite a bit of export. I think their comment was that they had to diversify into some more unique varieties unique qualities to capitalize on that export opportunity. But you're entirely right. The export opportunity has really fallen away, I think, with so many people leaving the market, which happened, what, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that big exodus? And that largely happened because there were so many imports. So,
yeah,
you know, bit of a vicious thing. But yeah, there, of course, there's an export opportunity for us if we can be productive enough and have the right quality product.
Yeah. And taking it right back to your farm and your experiences, what three things would you take if you had to leave the farm really quickly?
Oh, I wrote this down. my first one was so we actually imported some varieties of peonies.
Okay, yeah.
Right in the middle of COVID, which was an interesting experience. So I'd grab them.
Okay, yeah.
They were a real bugger to get into the country. So
yeah. Where did you import them from?
From the Netherlands.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So they would be going with me.
Yeah.
And when I thought about it, I kind of felt a bit bad because my next two things were pieces of clothing. It was my really long gloves, my goat skin gloves that go up to my elbows.
Yeah.
Because I just never get, you know, you never get scratched by the roses or anything when you've got them on. So it'd be them. And my boots. I've got this great pair of Jubarry boots at the farm. And I love them, and I would be grabbing them. So, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. What is your favourite tool?
My snips that are really long, thin ones.
Okay.
So they're not like they're not like normal pruners. They're like these really thin, and they're just really nimble, and you can – sort of cut very precisely and delicately, and I really like them. Yeah
Great. And do you, when you're sort of packing these crates and things to be shipped around, is there anything that's on your playlist in the shed?
Oh well, that's really a question for Elise.
Yeah,
who's in the place. But when we're out there, nothing in particular.
Okay.
Actually, when we're all working in the field, we often have your podcast on and we all listen to it as a group. So,
great.
So probably that's the main thing we listen to together. Yeah. You just sort of roll over episode to episode. It's like, you know, yeah.
Ah, wonderful. Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you really wanted to share about your experience so far or your farm or any insights into the industry that I haven't touched on?
I don't really think so. I mean, in the groups and stuff, you see people who want to start. Actually, yes, there is one point I will make. In the groups, when you see people wanting to start, and they're sort of asking all different questions and everything, and then you watch them and 6-12 months later, they all sort of start saying the same thing, which is, oh, my God, the weeds are killing me. So
yeah.
My thing to new growers would be, just get on top of your weeds from the outset, or they will get on top of you. And by that I mean either do something really, really small, or if you're going to do anything of any size, accept the fact that you have to use a weed barrier of some description. You have to use a felt, or you have to use a jute, or you have to use a plastic. You have to use something, or else you will kill yourself halfway through the season trying to deal with weeds.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I think it becomes really disappointing and disheartening for new growers when they really struggle with that when it's happening, and you feel a bit overwhelmed. And so I didn't listen to all the other growers giving that exact same advice enough when I started. And so I'm going to really say that is the number one thing you have to do above all else, really.
Yeah. And what do you use to combat your weeds?
So we use weed gunnel. Okay. You know, everyone has sort of different views. If it's exposed to the sun and the elements, it does break down pretty fast.
Mm.
It's very permeable to water, though, and it allows good gas exchanges with the soil. So it's kinder on your soil than a heavy-duty plastic. If you cover it with anything, it lasts very, very well. So in our walk rows, we have that and then wood chip mulch on top.
Okay.
And that is very effective and very durable. I know because we have it planted in parts of the truffles, and where it's covered by soil, 4 years you pull it up and it's still in great condition. So, we do have it on top of our flower beds, and it does degrade pretty quickly if it's exposed to the sun. And I'll sort of experiment with a few options as we go forward. But yeah, it is a good product, particularly because it's kinder on the soils, and so I do like it. And they're great. They're a great Australian business to deal with. So
yeah. And is it expensive?
It's not as expensive as some of the other options I looked at, like buying jute. Some growers talk about a product that they are bringing in from overseas, which is like a fabric. But the guy I saw write about it said that he brought in a whole shipping container load just for himself, and it was, you know, you got 1,001 tasks, and so it kind of just went lower down the list to work out what that was. But
yeah,
you really need to do something like that, otherwise you're just, I mean, there are different ways of doing it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just one of those tasks that it's so uneconomical.
Completely. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you
for chatting to me. And I've loved chatting to you. It's been a wonderful talk. So thank you so much.
It's been lovely. No, very happy to be part of it.
Thank you again to Charlotte for sharing your stories and your knowledge and your insights into our wonderful industry. What a powerhouse team you have there. If anyone would like to get in touch with Charlotte, you can do so via Instagram at September Peony Flower Farm. That's all for this week. If you would like to leave me a review, you can do so via Apple Podcasts. If you would like to get in touch, you can send me a direct message, or you can email me at dishthedirtpodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, if you are down in Victoria or anywhere where we're really feeling the pinch of winter, I hope that you're staying warm. If you're somewhere in the Northern Hemisphere, I hope that you are really enjoying your beautiful summer. Until next week, keep being blooming fabulous.